We stop fighting our inner experience and our internal feedback loops so that we can better attend to our external feedback loops in the present moment. And it's really simple training. And the research, I mean, there are literally thousands and thousands of studies. Like the ripple effect and the cascade effect of benefits for mindfulness training and application of mindful awareness is undeniable.
Welcome to the Mental Training Lab. I'm Pete Kadushin, your host, and my job is to have fun conversations that leave you with actionable tools, little experiments that will help you improve your mindset and mental skills so that you can do the things you love at a higher level.
This episode is round two with Dr. Raymond Pryor. This is an extension of our marathon recording session, and it builds off of episode 22. You don't need to listen to episode 22 to get the most out of this one, but you might want to check it out. As a quick refresher, Raymond has a PhD in sport and exercise psychology, and he's a performance consultant. He's worked with a bunch of different types of performers, including pro, college, and Olympic athletes, pop stars, actors, and high performers in the financial space. During this portion of our chat, Raymond spends a lot of time clarifying the three pillars of mindfulness: intention, groundedness, and acceptance. And he specifically spends some time talking about why acceptance is a superpower. We also talk about two specific mindfulness practices. We discuss both single point attention practice and open awareness. Whether you've meditated for a while or you're just interested in dipping your toes into the mindfulness pond, I think this episode is for you. And so, well, let's not wait any longer. Let's get right to it.
You know, I was going to ask a question here about like going back in a time machine and younger Raymond, because we've known each other for over a decade now, mm-hmm. and it would be a leading question because I've actually already asked you this question in the last month.
Yeah.
And so instead, I'll just point to when we've talked about what you know now that you maybe didn't focus on as much in the past, mindfulness came up quite frequently.
Mm-hmm.
And I think going back to that temporal alignment, right? Are you on time? Has a lot to do with that. And so I'd love to hear a little bit about how you've changed your mind about mindfulness, because you also brought up awareness
yeah.
as an important component as well. And so throw a few things at the wall and we'll see what sticks.
So mindfulness, let's clarify what mindfulness is, because I think there's some pop psych and some internet stuff that's making mindfulness sound like it's a state of non-thinking or a state of Zen or a relaxed state.
Yeah, and just clear your mind.
You just clear your mind of all thought. That is not what mindfulness is. Mindfulness is a type of awareness. Specifically, it is a type of awareness that is built on three pillars. The first pillar is intention. What intention means is I'm not reactive with my awareness. I am proactive with it, meaning I'm going to pay attention to stuff on purpose. And I'm going to train myself to pay attention to things on purpose, because if I'm paying attention and where I place that attention, now I'm in control of what I'm paying attention to. And then therefore that gives me far more opportunity to respond in a top down rather than bottom up way. Also, the reason we pay attention on purpose is because awareness for us, whatever kind it might be, whether it's reactive or proactive, is the first line of information processing for our nervous system. Like, think about all our senses. They are all making us aware of something. If we want to perform better, like you said, being on the front edge of whether it's the present moment or something. Well, if we want to be on the front edge, we're going to need to pay attention before we need to pay attention, so to speak. So intention, we're paying attention on purpose. The second part of mindfulness, and at least the pillar that it's built on, is groundedness. Groundedness means I'm paying attention to what's going on right now, not off time in another time frame that doesn't actually currently exist. Like, there's nothing morally wrong with being off time that is in the past or the future. It's just that we are not very high functioning when we are multitasking between time frames. And secondly, it also has a ripple effect and a cost to our just overall health. So there's about a bazillion research studies that show that people who are more present more often are happier, healthier, and higher functioning human beings. Not because of some Zen state that they snap into, but they are just, we are far better at addressing our current reality when we are actually in the same time frame that it exists in. The third pillar of mindfulness is acceptance, which means I'm not, in terms of our conversation, means I'm not fighting my feedback loops. So I'm not trying to turn my emotions off. I'm not trying to change my thoughts. I'm seeing them for what they are, but I'm also not treating them as necessarily as facts or certainties or something that I actually have to respond to. So what acceptance looks like is whatever I might be experiencing internally or externally, I'm not judging it for something that it should or shouldn't be, what I want it to be or what it isn't, which again, as we've kind of looping things back together from our earlier conversation, when we do that, it's not that it's right or wrong or good or bad. It's just that it is drastically pointing out the difference between what we are feeling and what we wish we were feeling. And that then again makes us feel worse.
Right.
And
right.
One of the ways we can make ourselves less resilient is to make ourselves feel worse. So in graduate school, I wish I had been more tuned into mindfulness and what it does and what it trains us to do, which is essentially we stop fighting our inner experience and our internal feedback loops so that we can better attend to our external feedback loops in the present moment. And it's really simple training, and the research, I mean, there are literally thousands and thousands of studies. Like the ripple effect and the cascade effect of benefits for mindfulness training and application of mindful awareness is undeniable. And that goes for things we might consider more clinical, like anxiety and depression. Not that it's a magic pill for anxiety or depression. And I'm just saying, do mindfulness training and all of a sudden your anxiety or depression will go away. That's not how it works. But people who practice mindfulness have a higher emotional intelligence. They have more connected relationships. Like, this type of awareness that is available to us if we train it opens the door to many other things, including better performance, period, end of sentence. So I wish I had been more in tune with that. And the great thing about it is if you train that awareness, you learn to interact with your internal and external feedback loops in a different direct experience. Like, experiencing a thought, treating it like it's a fact, and experiencing a thought, treating it as just like, there's an idea, is a vastly different direct experience with our own thoughts. One creates a ton of space for us to operate, the latter, and one is super constricting, which is like, if every thought pops into my head I treat as a fact, you're all over the place.
Well, and it goes back to the first pillar, intention, right? That when I'm not paying attention to things that are happening, and this is the conscious versus subconscious,
right?
But it also could be applied to what's going on in your body or, right? When you're not paying attention, they're still there.
They're still impacting your experience.
Right. And they're doing it without our capacity to be proactive about it.
That's right.
And so I often talk about literacy first, intelligence second, fitness third. Right. And it'll comply to psychological or just sort of your like cognitive intelligence, emotional intelligence, physical intelligence. But that idea that if I'm not bringing awareness to it on purpose first, then it's really hard. And you spoke with the example you're using, the 3-foot putts, that it gives people the language to understand their experience and troubleshoot that so they can be more objective.
Yeah.
And then apply their energy where they're going to get the most bang for their buck.
Yeah.
And so let's go back to the example of first tee jitters. So I can be aware of it first. I can be proactive and say, I want to be present to my experience. Right? And then again, all the stuff we discussed, right? So the racing thoughts and mostly unproductive thoughts. But I find that the volume, there's just more thoughts flying through your head as well.
There's typically more, and they're typically more intense.
And they're noisier.
They're noisy.
I feel like somebody turned the radio up and then they're jumping back and forth on all the stations too quickly. Right, so I have that experience. I notice it because I've been proactive. I've been intending to pay attention. And right now. That's the second pillar.
Right.
So what's going through my mind right now? I'm also, what's going through my body right now?
That's right.
Right. But the third piece is, we tickled this a little bit earlier, but now we're coming back to it, is accepting it for what it is.
That's right.
As opposed to saying, boy, I wish it should be, or I wish it was another way, or it should be another way.
Or make it something else. Right. So acceptance is us. Acceptance is, let's clarify acceptance. I think a layman's understanding of acceptance sees it as kind of a resignation for less, which is not what it is. So acceptance is not that we necessarily like something, that we are comfortable with it, that it is certain for us, that we are satisfied with it, or that we are resigning ourselves to less. What acceptance means is that we are in tune and honest and truthful about our past, present, and potential future experiences. And if we are willing to live with them, that provides us the space to act intentionally. And if we're talking really what the primary purpose for training your psychology is, so that your actions are more effective. Period, end of sentence. Like, our thoughts, our emotions, our sensations, any of our internal nervous system feedback loops actually have like no real bearing on our lives. It's our physical actions, our decisions that we make that actually become things that we do are what matters. If you're standing on the first tee and feeling deep anxiety, there's actually really no problem with that. If you hit a golf shot through anxiety, now you probably have a problem, in terms of you probably hit a golf shot that was immensely disrupted.
Mm-hmm.
Then it counts.
When it, going back to the language you used earlier, you're not able to execute freely when you are captured by the experience that you're having.
On many levels. So physiologically, there's muscle tension. Muscle tension reeling back to neurologically, we know that in states of wandering thought, anxiety, frustration, these states where we are not in alignment, as I would say, our brain activity, quite frankly, because we are thinking about so much, right? So anxiety is worry about the future. So we are not just thinking about the present, we are also thinking about the future. Frustration and anger live in the past, so we are thinking about the past. It creates more brain activity for us. And we know that when our brain activity, you know, if we're getting really into the nitty gritty, we're talking our alpha and theta waves here. When they get frequent enough and intense enough, there's too much traffic on the roadway of our nervous system to be able to send messages fast enough. And we know, particularly in performance, there are a variety of studies in music, medicine, and in sport, and I know for sure in golf, that show this type of brain activity disrupts three things. First, it disrupts our physical sequencing. And any performance, physical movement, there's sequencing that is more effective than other sequences.
Yeah, timing matters.
Timing matters. It also impacts our ability to apply the appropriate amount of force. So if you're hitting a golf shot, there's such thing as hitting it too far or not far enough. If you're playing the guitar, there's such thing as playing a note too hard and too soft, depending on how that composition is created. Even if you're a distance runner and it is about applying a lot of effort, you run yourself right out of a race if you're anxiety, because you'll burn through, you'll apply too much force too early, and your stride will not be in sequence in the way you want to if you're doing that out of anxiety, right?
I mean, you're not just going out too fast, but you're also wasting more energy because you're just not as efficient as a runner.
And then the last thing that we know that this high frequency, high intensity brainwaves do is they make it far more difficult for us to be visually and attentionally focused on where our performance happens. So for your target sports, that means you're having a hard time seeing and attending to a glove, a receiver, a putting line. For many of my clients who are the pop stars, it means your focus is anywhere but the crowd, the microphone, your instrument, etc. And of course, that is going to ultimately disrupt what you're doing. Where anxiety comes from is our psychology. And so as we've kind of been peeling back the layers here, we're seeing that if you have your, as you said, if you are doing good housekeeping on your psychology, your neurology tends to follow without you having to fight it, which only makes it more intense and more frequent. And then ultimately that opens the door for us to go, okay, well, how do I actually intend to execute this skill rather than trying to, create more interference with it. Like, in kind of a plain way, people who are really psychologically strong, it's not that the tasks they're doing become easier to them, they're just not making them harder than they really are.
Mm-hmm.
With all these competing tasks, you know, if you just think about the human brain, technically we can multitask. Like, you and I are both sitting, speaking, and making eye contact and listening at the same time. Like, we're doing multiple tasks. But as those tasks require more precision, more accuracy, more nuance, or perhaps they are in settings where when they become disrupted, it becomes more costly. Multitasking, we actually really suck at it. So we're not actually technically multitasking. We're toggling back and forth between tasks, which requires a lot of thinking. And then, of course, then creates more brain activity.
Costs a lot of energy.
It does. And then what really gets disruptive to us in performance is when the tasks that we are multitasking are moving in opposite directions, which is I am pursuing executing my skills the way I want to while also multitasking with not trying to screw them up. So I have a pursuit task and avoidance task at the same time. And if I asked you to stand up and sit down at the same time, you would literally go nowhere, or you would eventually have to pick one. And now we'll loop this all the way back around. If given the choice between multitasking, between pursuit and avoidance, the stronger, faster parts of our brain that only care about survival and don't know the difference between what's real and what's not will win out. And so if we are not mindful of our feedback loops, we are essentially hoping that our old brain is working in our favor, and it is specifically designed not to.
Yeah, I mean, it'll keep us alive, and that's not going to be great in the conditions of a golf tournament or an important hockey game or a big concert.
That's right. If we're in survival mode in a thriving setting, it's not helpful for us. It's also not very enjoyable, and it actually, depending on what sport you're in, can be dangerous to you. Like if you're playing in the NHL and you're in survival mode and you're being hesitant, like you're far more likely to be injured, not just not perform well, because you're not going to be skating at the speed to be able to protect yourself. Like there's 1,000 NFL coaches who tell me, like, when guys are being hesitant, I have to get them off the field, not just because they're not playing well, but because they're going to get hurt.
Yeah, for their own safety.
Right.
And I think this is one of the biggest shifts, not just in performance psychology, but in psychology in general, that we've seen now with some of these third wave approaches and theories, is that it's less about engaging thoughts directly. There was a great title to an article back in like the early 2010s called You Can't Wash Blood with Blood, which I guess is an old Buddhist adage.
That's right.
That's number two for today.
There you go.
But the idea that you can't fight thinking with thinking.
Yeah.
You're just going to think more.
It's just more
and
thinking.
It's just more volume. And you've pointed That's to right. the consequence of that high volume, high intensity, and how that can gobble up the bandwidth.
Yeah. Thinking your way out of anxiety is not going to work, particularly in settings where your old brain is engaged. Like you said, we don't typically change our mind with our mind. You're not going to change your thoughts with your thoughts, particularly in those settings. You have to change your direct experience with them. If you change your direct experience with your own thoughts, that is seeing them differently as just a thought and not necessarily reality, and you train that, because your direct experience is different with your thoughts and feelings, you can see that as like, oh, that's just my old brain's reflexive feedback loop. Then you have the space to be able to ground yourself in the present and align your focus. Or when you do try to remind yourself of something or say something to yourself, it has a whole lot more credibility, because telling yourself you're fine when every feedback loop in your body is telling you, no, you're not, has zero credibility to it.
I got this. Yeah. I got this. It's no problem. Your That's body's right. on five alarm, fire, That's red right. alert. And yeah, we're coming back to credible inner dialogue. We've already teased out some of this here, right? But I think it's useful to point to the fact that we can operate at a very high level with a wide array of internal experiences.
Comfort, certainty, trust, commitment, like all these kind of subjective terms to us are not at all required to perform well. Now, some of them are very helpful, but not required.
And the point I think that we're driving towards is, I have the experience on the first tee. Right. And that the mantra that I use with a lot of my athletes is no big deal, not because it's pleasant, right? We've already talked about how it's not something that I want to invite in, and acceptance isn't saying, boy, this is just the best.
That's right.
Right. But I can have a profoundly uncomfortable and unpleasant experience and then still execute.
And it's also amazing that if we bring that type of prism to our discomfort and uncertainty, how it starts to become not a very big deal. Right? Like if we go, uh-oh, being uncomfortable and uncertain is a big deal, I can't perform well, it's now a big deal. If you go, oh, I feel really anxious, okay, no big deal, because that's just a feeling and an internal feedback loop or a perseverative thought pattern, I can recognize it as such, mindfully be aware of it, and then also pay attention to, well, what can I do instead, which oftentimes is nothing, followed by, how about what's required of me just like right now? Then it doesn't become a big deal to be anxious. And when we do that, as we talked about a little bit before, when we do this again and again, responding to the same things with anxiety starts to lose its appeal to our brain. And we start to develop a new reflex, which would be, oh, first tee, how about that? it feels a whole lot better and works a whole lot better for me to just be focused on executing a shot and move on with my life. And that is a nice place to be in when people get to it.
And it doesn't happen by accident. It is the thing that we're pointing towards.
It won't happen by accident.
Because like, our brain's not aligned that way.
If you're talking about the way the universe would have to align and things to fall into place for us to meet that criteria for a brain that is designed to do the exact opposite, like, get out of here. The way I call that with my athletes is like, you're waiting for the stars to align. Like, it ain't happening, dude. Stop waiting for it.
All right. So we've already done our deep dive. To wrap up just this portion of it, I'm curious, is there a go-to exercise when it comes to strengthening those three pillars, right? So the intention, the presence or groundedness, sure, and then that capacity for acceptance. Is there something that you think is particularly potent?
There are, I think, the two most basic mindfulness practices are just amazing for it. The first is there are two broad categories of mindfulness training. There is single point, which is named because you're focusing on a single point. For most athletes and performers, a breath-centered mindfulness practice is key. The reason being, their breath is always available to them. It is a colossal waste of time to tell yourself to just be present, because again, you're fighting thoughts with thoughts. We ground ourselves in the present through direct experience. That is what it feels like to be present. So in a breath-centered mindfulness practice, essentially what you would start is you would first identify what it means to what I call connect with your breath. Connecting with your breath means I am intentionally bringing my awareness to where I physically feel my breath in the present moment without needing to change it, without needing to judge it for being a good breath, a deep enough breath, whatever, but just paying attention. So the question I ask my clients is, if you're paying attention to your breath, what is the physical sensation you're feeling that tells you you're breathing right now? That can be the sensation of air coming in your nose and out your mouth. It can be the rise and fall of your chest or your abdomen. It can be, first, depending on the sport you're in, like if you have earplugs in, oftentimes you can hear your breath. But it's more than just be present. It's like, what is physically telling you you're in the present moment right now? So you are grounding yourself in the physical experience of being present. In the practice, you begin with that connection to your breath.
Because I imagine we have some meditators out there that are nodding their head saying, well, you can think about your breathing.
You can.
And you can convince yourself that you're actually in the present moment when really you're lost in thought about your breath as opposed to directly connected to the experience of breathing.
And what we know neurologically is the more senses you orient to the present moment, the more your brain goes, oh, yeah, this is where we are. So if you're a meditator, you can just think about your breath, but I would say in these high stakes settings and performance settings, it is far more valuable for us to have something physical, almost tangible that tells you like, hey, present moment for your brain. So in this practice, you begin by learning to just connect with your breath, which in other ways goes like you're just training yourself to be present in a tangible way. In this practice, inevitably your thoughts and your sensations are going to move off your breath. Which is just fine, by the way.
I used to do a 60-second test in classes where I'd have everybody close their eyes, mm-hmm, and we'd go through what you just described, where are you connecting physically to your breath, and then use that as your anchor point. And then after the 60 seconds would be finished, I'd have everybody raise their hand who hadn't been distracted for, mm-hmm, the 60 seconds. And you'd inevitably get one or two people who'd raise their hand, and I'd go, you're lying.
Yeah, you're a liar.
I'm not trying to be hurtful. I'm not trying to question your experience, but having meditated for a while now, there's no way you made it 60 seconds without your mind wandering just a little.
Yeah, so our brain is designed to look for things to attend to. And so in this 5 minutes, let's say it's a 5-minute breath center mindfulness practice. When you connect with your breath, that's where you start. You're going to move away from your breath. It's going to happen. And that is not a problem. What we do is we observe those as just natural shifts in focus. And if you observe it as just a shift in focus away from your breath, then it's no big deal, as you would say. And then what we do is we also just use that as an opportunity to reconnect with your breath. So what you're training is your ability to tangibly ground yourself in the present, observe with acceptance when your focus isn't on the present or you're getting a different feedback loop that isn't your breath, and to use that as an opportunity to just go, okay, and then return to being present. And what this does is it eliminates the need for us to try to be present just by telling ourselves to be present. It also eliminates the need for us to try to be present for our entire performance, which is almost never going to happen. And what it trains us to be able to do is be present, more mindfully recognize when we are not, which is that active, like I'm going to pay attention to when I'm not grounded, which then again provides me the opportunity to go, how about I can be regrounded? And again, being in the present isn't about some Zen state or some existential or philosophical thing for performance. It's about you are at your highest functioning when you're present and you are attending to the task that is in front of you when it's in front of you. And so this practice for performance is invaluable. For the rest of our lives, it's also immensely valuable. So that would be practice one.
I can't really think of a time where being somewhere else as opposed to the present moment is improving performance outside of maybe if you're like a novel writer, right? But even then you're intentionally putting yourself in a state of creativity. And so you might be projecting your mind elsewhere, but you're grounded in the present in order to do it.
Yeah. I mean, the task is still to bring that projection into the present in the form of some type of writing. So there's certainly a time for us to be able to think about the future or review the past. Like it's really valuable for us to be able to be off time and for our brain to be able to understand things in the past and plan for things in the future. We don't perform very well though when we're doing that. And so it's not a bad thing to be off time, but it's really valuable for us to be on time when we are performing. And quite honestly, the more of our lives we are more present and less distracted, like we are happier, healthier, higher functioning human beings. So that would be practice number one. That's our single point practice.
Yeah. You're going to give us practice number two
practice
as well?
Practice number two is just the second category of mindfulness practice is just contemplative. And what that is it's really just exploring a really fluid and flexible and accepting relationship with your thoughts where you're essentially just looking at them and seeing them as no big deal. So what that practice would look like is you would sit like you would in a breath center practice. You would start by connecting with your breath just to ground yourself. And then you would just let your thoughts go wherever they go. And just without trying to change them, without trying to judge them, without giving them any subjective value as being good or bad or right or wrong, just observe them and watch how they stitch together, wherever they might go. And essentially what you're doing is you're telling your brain, go think freely, and I'm going to treat it as no big deal for 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And what this does is it trains our capacity to have thoughts, any thoughts, even the most disruptive, asinine ideas. And they really not mean anything to us other than it is just a mental event that may or may not be relevant, may or may not be helpful, and very likely has nothing to do with what we're doing right now, or maybe it does. And so essentially what happens is we train ourselves to be able to just go, thought. And if you can go, thought, your thoughts, you experience them directly with far less weight. And if your thoughts are less heavy, you can step away from them and focus on what you want to do, which again, what we're getting to is ultimately, can you act in ways that you intend to act when rubber hits the road for you rather than trying to fight your thoughts? Because if you can see your thoughts as just an idea, even the worst thoughts you might have, they're not very disruptive for us.
And it comes back to freedom, right? Then I'm not hand-tied or handcuffed or, you know, it's stuck.
To have to wrestling, think about a certain way.
Wrestling with my thoughts because inevitably the profile of thoughts isn't going to match exactly what I want it to. And
very rarely it does. You know, so this would kind of debunk our idea that like you have to think positive or you have to think a certain way. Like I can't tell you how many athletes I see and sometimes clients I have where like they are afraid of their thoughts.
No.
To the point where they're always trying to sweep them under the rug or make sure that no one says something that is disruptive to them because if they have them, because they can't see them as just a thought that is negative, quote unquote, but who cares because it's just a thought, they get stuck to them and then it becomes a real problem for them.
Yeah, I mean, I call this holding yourself hostage.
Yeah.
Right? You got yourself stuffed in the trunk, duct tape over your mouth, but you're the one who did it.
Yeah.
Because you've decided that a certain condition needs to be met in order to perform.
Yeah. And you know, if we're talking about what is actually required for us to perform well, technically thinking in a certain way is not. Really what we're talking about is to perform well, it's the physical task required without me adding any extra multitasks to it, especially competing ones. And if you're always fighting your thoughts or trying to avoid them, you always have an extra task that you're attending to. And so with this contemplative practice, it's also called drunken monkey mindfulness, because you kind of watch your thoughts like it's a drunken monkey, you're just kind bouncing of bouncing around, right? Then you learn to not have to attend to the drunken monkey. And if you don't have to pay attention and try to manage the drunken monkey, then you're free to do the thing that you do while that thing just does what it does. And oftentimes when we do that, because our thoughts become a whole lot less sticky, like the drunken monkey kind of like loses its energy.
And I think there's an important point here about this type of open awareness is it's paying attention to your mind without using a specific anchor, right? Correct. Allowing whatever comes in. And I have an interesting visual when I sit down to do this is as if you were like in a cabin in the woods, and the only thing in the cabin was a single chair in the center of the cabin, and you opened all the windows and all the doors and you left them open and you just were curious to see what showed up.
Yeah.
But you don't want your thoughts to carry you away, right? So that would be the equivalent of like hearing a bear coming and then running out the back
That's
door
right.
or seeing a really cool squirrel and being like, well, I want to know where that squirrel lives.
Yeah.
And so it's, I find the single point awareness helps anchor us and teach that skill. So I usually bring that one to mm-hmm. the table first, because then once I've started to learn how to be non-reactive, which isn't ignoring or pretending that something's not there,
That's
it's
right.
not needing it to go away, but it just means that I'm not stuck to it unless I actively intentionally decide that I want to follow
yeah,
it.
Yeah, that phrase you used is like right on, non-reactive. There's a difference between seeing something and not reacting to it, right? Like observing something like, man, that is a terrible thought. Okay. It's very different than don't have a terrible thought.
Or getting, you know, 5 years down the road of the consequence of when that terrible thought and then this and then that and then this.
That's right.
And so just like we would refocus on an anchor with the single point, come back to our breath mm-hmm. and just notice it's actually, I talk about it as reps, right? As athletes understand reps. And so it's not about being 100% focused for the entire 5 minutes. It's about noticing and coming back, because that's really where the magic's going to be at.
Yeah. The point where we notice that we are not connected to our breath, like that's neurologically and psychologically, that's the space we want. We want, like, you know, sometimes my clients will say, hey, I had a great mindfulness practice. I only noticed that I moved off my breath once. I'm like, okay, cool. And then the next day I'll be like, oh, terrible mindfulness practice. Like 50 times I had to reconnect with my breath. And I'm like, actually, dude, the okay. second one,
cool,
more valuable to you.
Yeah.
Because the more reps you can get going, oh, that's not my breath, which basically means, oh, that's not the present moment. And recognizing that and returning, you're flexing and strengthening your grounding muscle more than, oh, today I just, my thoughts were kind of in line.
And the same is then true for this contemplative practice, where there's a different felt experience, a direct yeah. experience of watching our thoughts with some perspective or some space.
Yeah.
Space. Or being lost in thought. Yeah. And I think when we notice, that's the moment to reground ourselves, climb back into the chair in the center of the cabin and say, okay, I can go back to watching and letting them flow.
Just observing. And when we just observe our thoughts, like you said, the direct experience then becomes different. So if you're using your cabin analogy, you realize like, oh, it's just the thought about a bear. I don't actually have to run with it. It's just a thought. Or, oh, it's a squirrel, which is like, oh, that would be a cool thought to entertain. And like, actually, I don't have to do that. I can just be like, oh, okay, squirrel. Oh, okay, bear. And then that really becomes valuable to us when instead of bear and squirrel, it becomes, what if I fail?
Okay, that's a wrap. As always, thank you for offering up your most valuable resources, your time and attention, while you listen to this episode. You can find all the episodes of the Mental Training Lab at mtl.academy. That's mtl.academy. And look, I know this is the spot where I'm supposed to tell you to subscribe to the show or leave a review or whatever, but I'll be honest, I've only got one real request. If you found anything in this show helpful and you know someone who could benefit from these ideas or tools, just go ahead and send it their way. All right, that's all for now. I'll see you next episode.